heart and soul of a nation, beckons the call. The voice of our forefathers heard in the distance.
A house divided against itself cannot stand.
To reclaim our honor.
Our soul. The challenges of a generation call out. Future generations hang in the balance. We choose liberty. This is the voice of a nation. And now, Malcolm.
Well, Iowa was the first state to pass the heartbeat laws in 2018, actually, but it was immediately challenged, and the Iowa Supreme Court knocked it down. We're going to take that on and much more, talk about a lot of the hot buttons here in the nation here with Congressman Stephen King. Representative King represents Iowa's 4th Congressional District, and I think it was you've been there since 2003.
That is correct. So I've enjoyed this task that's ahead of me, but we've got a lot of work to do yet, Malcolm.
Yeah, you sure do. I hear you, buddy. Yeah. So let's get into this latest thing that happened over the past week here. And you've asked for an apology now for a lot of both the left and the right, and of course the media. And you said here, what if we went back through all the family trees and just pulled those people out that were products of rape and incest? Now, this was speaking again about abortion. Would there be any population of the world left if we did that? You were talking, I guess, in Urbandale, I believe it was, in Iowa?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty close to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you said, considering all the wars and all the rapes and pillages taking place and whatever happened to culture after society, I know I cannot certify that I'm not part of a product of that myself. I want to just open it up and have you explain where you were going with that.
Well, I think one way to do this is most people have seen the movie It's a Wonderful Life, when George Bailey said, "I wish I had never been born," and the angel Clarence said to him, "Oh, there's an idea. I'll take you and show you what it'd been like if you'd have never been born." He sees his brother's gravestone, whose life he saved when he fell through the ice at age 9, and this is the brother that saved an entire troop ship in the Second World War. He wouldn't have been there to do that. The house was a shambles. His beautiful wife, Donna Reed, who grew up in my hometown, ends up an old maid. And so think of that image in a personal way. What happens? Now, if you go back through the family trees all the way back to Adam, and you just snip those branches off of those who are products of rape or incest, who could certify that there's a branch left after even 1,000 generations? And Lord knows how many generations there's actually have been.
Yeah. All right. So here's what's interesting about what you say there. What you were doing is trying to get people to think, and you were trying to get them to think outside of the lines a little bit about, first of all, the value of life, clearly, and second of all, the repercussions for this. So let me ask you straight out. Do you believe rape and incest should not allow for abortion as well? I mean, is that what you're saying?
Well, my position is that we don't make exceptions when we protect the lives of the innocent unborn. We don't make exceptions for rape or incest. Mm-hmm. Those are the sins almost always of the father. And we cannot be, I'll say, executing the child for the sins of the father. It's a moral affront when you think about it in those terms. And so what I'm saying to people is, what I run into is the real principle of pro-life people understand this and they stand with me. And in fact, that principle is in the platform of the Republican Party of Iowa and in the Republican National Committee's platform of 2016. No exceptions for rape or incest. It's explicit in Iowa, and it's incorporated into the language a little bit differently at the national level. So we understand this. We had 174 co-sponsors on my heartbeat bill without exceptions in Congress. And yet when I run into people that are Democrats just aren't pro-life anymore, and I say that virtually. There are a few that are, and I really appreciate them. But then on the Republican side, there are the establishment Republicans generally, they will defend rape and incest exceptions. And when I look at them, I realize this, that to them, being pro-life is a political calculation, not a deep conviction that comes out of, say, our theology, our faith, our respect for the value of human life, which is so intrinsic that it is the measure itself against which all other things are weighed. So that's how this thing comes down, Malcolm.
Yeah. Well, a lot of women would say, you always hear the words, it's my body, I'm going to do what I want. I mean, that's the talking point that comes across here. But in the case of a woman that is violated and that is brutally raped in some way, well, they're a victim, first of all, in that sense. But then many women feel they're double a victim if the government tells them they have to keep the baby that they wish not to keep. This is a conversation that divides the country and has since Roe versus Wade and well before that, in fact. Do you ever see the country? The country's never going to come together on this point, are they?
The country is moving in the direction to defend all innocent born human life. It's something I would have never predicted 20 years ago or so, that there would be a Supreme Court decision that imposed same-sex marriage on all of America without hardly a whimper of protest across society, not by the will of the people, by order of the court. And at the same time that same-sex marriage is essentially accepted in the society and culture, you've got a pro-life movement moving the opposite direction towards life. And we ran polls on the heartbeat bill nationally, and I don't have that in front of me, but I remember this number, 61% of Americans supported the heartbeat bill without exceptions.
Yeah.
That's a pretty strong majority when Democrats, 55% of Democrats, about 85 or 86% of Republicans.
Yeah, and the reason I think that probably happened is because there was a lot of heat with the infanticide, right? I mean, that became a big talking point nationally, and I think people were outraged the fact that they were willing to kill babies outside the womb, correct?
Well, I say yes, maybe, but this poll was run before that topic came up. I mean, I would index infanticide as when the midterm elections, once the Democrats took over the majority of the House, that was the dialogue coming into that, and it's initiated most likely by Governor Northam down in Virginia. So I think we measured the public before that topic came up, but that's also where we were on the cusp of passing the heartbeat bill on the floor of the House of Representatives. I had the votes in the Judiciary Committee to peel off any amendments, which certainly would have been the attempt to apply exceptions for rape and incest. And the votes on the floor, I believe, were there, and it was blocked by leadership. And it's the leadership that says rape and incest exceptions are necessary, and they Kevin McCarthy asserted that they were in our platform, and of course they are not.
Yeah.
So we ran into that, but if we had moved that heartbeat bill and passed it and set it on Mitch McConnell's desk, even in the lame duck session, even with one day left, we would have put an end to the debate in America, or at least taken a long ways towards the end of the debate in America on rape and incest exceptions, because the strong statement that it's not the baby's fault, and you just simply can't execute the baby for the sins of the father.
Yeah, well, there's something to what you say there that is logical. It sounds like common sense, but for many, it's not. They consider it a violation. Talk to me about, I think with anything that becomes unlawful, Steve, anything that is outlawed, there always becomes a black market. And that was true with abortion. There were a lot of back alley abortions, and they were very common. In fact, there were more deaths, they say, is what the left would say to that. How do we defend that?
Well, I would say that there are over 60 million deaths since Roe versus Wade, and they count too. And I would say also there were far, far fewer abortions before Roe versus Wade. And there are, I'm going to say, millions of people alive today into the second, third, and fourth generation and beyond who wouldn't be walking this planet today if abortion had been, you know, as Bill Clinton and Hillary used to say, safe, legal, and rare. Now it's just legal.
That's right.
It's not about being safe or rare at all anymore. So I think we ought to count the value of those people that were born because the law protected them. Yeah, this country is populated with them in significant numbers, and their lives are precious too. And what we don't get around to lamenting here, think of the demographics of America today. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hear this clamor always that, what are you going to do to find me labor for my factory that I've just built, and I don't have enough people to punch the time clock and make me rich? And I say it's not my job to do that, but they never want to hear there are 60 million babies that are missing because of Roe versus Wade, and they don't want to hear also about the second and even the third generation that would be born to those babies that were aborted. That's probably over 100 million Americans missing because of Roe versus Wade. That's a third of us.
Well, we're talking about a whole different country at that point. You know that. I mean, we're right? I mean, we're talking about a whole, it's amazing when you think about it in the terms of what you put out there, Steve. It really is amazing because you think back and you think, wow, that would change a lot of things. I mean, who knows what it would change, which was your point, obviously. You know, one of the things that does come up in this argument, back to what you just said about workers, where they say those workers are and where they want to replace them, not to mix the conversation here, but is with illegal immigrants. That's where they want to get the workers from.
Well, that's true. And I have them pressing me for that labor on a regular basis. I'll probably hear it again in my town hall meeting that I'm doing today. But there's a whole other topic there about where all of the Americans, we found 107 million Americans in categories from which you could hire some. That labor's out there in this country, and it's closer than, say, San Salvador. But these operations around here want that labor out of Central America, because they'll work cheap and because they can, and because they will behave and they'll show up and they'll live by the rules and they'll put out a day's work. They don't want to start managing young people coming out of the inner cities where the highest unemployment we have. And in fact, that is rooted in, at least what has a component of racism in it. There are a lot of inequities here that need to be addressed, but the most important one, and by the way, Malcolm, you know, even clear back founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence, when they put in the Declaration the values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those values were not just randomly selected and strung in there by Thomas Jefferson. They were prioritized rights. Life comes first. It is the most important thing. Life trumps liberty, and liberty trumps pursuit of happiness. Life trumps liberty and pursuit of happiness. And so the mother, in exercising her liberty, can do all kinds of things within that liberty, but not take the life of the baby. That baby's got a soul and a unique DNA, and there's somebody wants that baby, whether she does or not. There are at least 500,000 couples in America waiting to adopt.
Yeah.
I sat down with the president and had a conversation on this, and I brought in my chief of staff, who is was up until January for a long time the youngest chief of staff on the Hill. And the president will provoke, he's provocative in his conversations. He'll throw hypothetical scenarios at you. And so one of them he threw at me was, and I won't describe it in detail because I respect the privacy of those one-on-one conversations, especially in the Oval Office. But it was a hypothetical about, and he said, well, what do you say when, and he described one of the worst scenarios you could think of for a child that would be a product of rape. And then I gave my answer, and then he turned to my chief of staff, Sarah, and said, would you like it if you were raped by this individual and the government told you you had to have the baby? And she looked him in the eye with that most innocent look, and she said, and she just had a little baby 2 months earlier, and she said, they wouldn't have to tell me to do that, Mr. President. It's not the baby's fault. And he turned to me and said, where do you find these people? And I said, they're all over America, Mr. President. And so that's, I just wanted to relate that narrative on how that unfolded there that day. And I'm not reflecting the president's opinion. I'm only reflecting what Sarah had to say in response.
Well, you know, Congressman, the president gets away with a lot more when he does talk that way than anyone, including you, as you've seen with the media recently, right? I mean, he has a unique position, and he's been able to use that the bully pulpit there to really put it out there. He's changed. We'll talk about him in a little bit here because he has changed the political landscape clearly. I want to talk to you about the religious component on this because this is something I truly don't understand, and that is within the church. Why is it that we can't compute any of that? That it there's no reckoning for those positions within the church. What's going on?
Well, I think the church is afraid to alienate. But we're talking about the Catholic Church especially.
Exactly.
I think the Catholic Church is afraid to alienate something probably more than half of their parishioners. And, you know, I when we had Pope Francis came to Washington and he celebrated Mass at National Stadium there, and I went out there, and this was back when Teddy Kennedy was still alive. And, of course, he was a strong proponent of abortion, as was John Kerry.
Right.
And so I'm sitting there in fairly elite seats. They were good seats. Teddy Kennedy was he's carrying more weight than we imagine now, but at that time he was probably peaked out. And so I don't know by the vestments, but I suspect it was a bishop that came over and served a communion to Teddy Kennedy sitting there, all on national television, a great big illuminated shot of Teddy Kennedy receiving communion in National Stadium at a service celebrated by the Pope. And then I got up to go to communion. Who was in front of me that I followed to communion? John Kerry. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, those images are so powerful that it gives many people license. And it isn't just the images by any means, but it's that there's politics within the church. And but I will say, though, that the Conference of Catholic Bishops, the American Conference of Catholic Bishops, endorsed my heartbeat bill last year. Mm-hmm. And that took a little doing, but the precepts of the church haven't changed. Yeah. But they're not as strong as I think they should be.
Do you see that bill in Iowa resurfacing, by the way, the heartbeat bill?
In Iowa, of course, it's law suspended by a Supreme Court decision. Mm-hmm. We really didn't take it to the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court came down with finding a 72-hour waiting time rule for abortion to be unconstitutional as an undue burden. And so we may have cracked that out of there and gotten it to federal court. And by the time those decisions were made, it had gotten away from me where I wasn't right on top of those legal decisions that other people were handling that. We lined up the defense for it, and it was the St. Thomas More Foundation that defended it. I think there was another opportunity that could have gotten it out and into federal court. The governor didn't elect to do that. But we also have, and my count actually was 10 states that have passed some form of heartbeat, and one of them was personhood that includes heartbeat, so maybe 9 technically. But the more states that pass heartbeat, and we have an epidemic of heartbeat bills being passed, I mean, that's why those numbers are so high, that pushes it towards the Supreme Court. I think they have to hear a case there. And at the federal level, if Nancy Pelosi gives up the gavel to a Republican speaker, then we're back in this again, and we're in a good spot to pass the heartbeat bill out of the House. As I said, we could have done this any time in 2018. And it was a political calculation that blocked my bill. And when I look back on this now and I add up all the little conversations that were stringing this thing along, it was slow walked out to the end. And finally, when I put my foot down, I got the blank no, it's not moving with no reason and no excuses. So that tells me that they hope to never have to give me that straight an answer, but they did. So that's where I think it goes. And I should tell people also that are listening in on this conversation, Malcolm, that when they see a lower court put an injunction against pro-life legislation, it is this, that no lower court is going to even attempt to overrule the Supreme Court. So this has to be appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court. They're going to follow Roe versus Wade, Doe versus Bolton, and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And that's so all of the lower courts are bound by that. And so we have to just continue to litigate this thing until we get it before the Supreme Court. And then at that point, I think I'm convinced we get significant improvement, if not an all out approval of heartbeat legislation. One other comment that a piece that I think people need to know is, and this discussion about rape in particular, you know, we have rape kits out there that we haven't had up until, you know, recent years. But that's something that a victim can utilize. And this heartbeat legislation takes it out about 6 weeks before the heartbeat can be detected generally, at least as far as legislation that I've written does. And so that gives the victim those 6 weeks or so a window to do what I wouldn't recommend, but what she might decide to do. And you've got the morning after pill and RU486, those things. So, you know, this isn't like if you're raped, you're going to have the baby, and you should know that the morning after. 6 weeks later is the time that the heartbeat appears that baby would be protected.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because that's an excellent point to bring up, Congressman, with the pill and things of that nature. So there are things that can be done, and that is a great point, actually. I forgot about that. To remind listeners, they're the pill itself that can change that future right there in a safe and manner before it ever is a heartbeat, right? I mean, that's the whole idea of it, Clay, you know. So
yeah, that is. And then while I'm on that topic, let's go to the incest side of this. And I'm no expert on incest, but the folks that have studied this, they tell me this, that you have circumstances within families where maybe a father and a daughter And when she gets pregnant from incest, he takes her off to the abortion clinic and they eliminate the evidence of that crime by abortion. Then they're back into that cycle again, over and over again. Wow. If you ban that abortion, then that stops the cycle of incest that might go on for years and years. Wow. So in the end, that may be more merciful on balance. It certainly is a way to look at it that we need to consider.
Interesting points. And you know what comes to my mind is you think we got problems right now. Can you imagine the left when they lose their head and the civil unrest, if this gets to the Supreme Court and Roe versus Wade is turned over? Wow. What a day that'll be, people. More Voice of a Nation in just a moment.
Listen to Malcolm, the Voice of a Nation on iHeartRadio or our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa.
It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the People, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio. One of the things we consistently see is the unity on the left when it comes to things like this. It seems to me like the left, they're very good at staying together, no matter what the plight is or what the conversation is. The right, not so much. But I have to tell you, we're speaking here with Congressman Stephen King in the 4th District, again, out of Iowa. And he came under some heat this past week for some comments that he said, which really he was just trying to make you think, and no different than President Trump would do, really, because these are thinkers. These are people that put things out to make us think. And he talked about, let's say with rape and incest, how many of us wouldn't be here if that had happened to their lives and their families and so on and so forth? And it certainly makes you think how that would have changed the fabric of our nation. And the plight of Black Americans, abortion is the biggest killer in Black America. So that's a whole other conversation, people, there. I want to talk about unity next, and the unity on the left, but the lack of the unity on the right. Representative Liz Cheney comes out from Wyoming. Of course, she's the third highest ranking Republican in the House. She says it's time for him to go. Speaking of Representative Stephen King, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy comes out. He tells Fox News in an interview that the comments on rape and incest justify his decision earlier this year to strip him of his assignments on the Judiciary and Agricultural Committees because of racist comments he made in January. Congressman, you've been under some heat within your own party. The GOP, they're just not as good as staying together as the left is. How are you handling that within the party itself?
Well, I'd say, how would you like to share a foxhole with either Kevin McCarthy or Liz Cheney? I think they'd frag you. And add Steve Stivers to that while you're at it. We're supposed to be circled together as a party, as a team, right. And we're supposed to adhere to the values that are reflected within our platform. And whatever kind of controversy has followed me along over the years, right. It's every time I've been attacked by fellow Republicans for defending principled conservative values. And this happened again. If Kevin McCarthy had to take his case against me before a court of law, even a liberal judge would throw it out of court at the first look because he doesn't have an ounce of evidence for anything except he decides that the reporter of the New York Times is more honest than I am. And, I point out that Brett Kavanaugh went through just a terrible excoriation, yeah. But he had about six accusers, none of which were corroborated. I've lived a lifetime out of the same place, with neighbors and family and friends, and swam in the fishbowl for the public life for 25 years. And still, I don't have a single accuser, not one. There's not one person that has alleged that they've had an uncomfortable experience with me or they were ever disparaged or insulted, anything other than treated with respect, regardless of their race, ethnicity, national origin, or whatever their particular identity might be. And Kevin McCarthy has zero evidence of any of that, All he has is a New York Times misquote from Tripp Gabriel, who says that he can type accurately and punctuate accurately as fast as anybody can talk. And when I go to the stenographers on the floor of the House who have to type as fast as I talk when I give a speech, they say, I've got this magic keyboard that does 280 words a minute that's set up as a stenographer, and I can't keep up with you, Congressman. I have to go back and listen to the tape. I know Tripp Gabriel can't do that. Kevin McCarthy has to know that. This fits his narrative because he wants somebody that he can tell what to do. And that's a big part of this. But a bigger part yet is the role that I've played in the First of the Nation caucus process here in Iowa and the filter that we've set up that allows for principled constitutional conservatives to flow through that and have an opportunity to have access to caucus goers. And their establishment candidates know that they don't have traction in Iowa. And until they get me out of the way, they're not going to be able to bring a Jeb Bush or a Chris Christie or some of those moderate candidates forward and get them nominated for president. And that's probably over half of what this is about. If I were from Nebraska, South Dakota, or Minnesota rather than Iowa, you never would have heard a word of any of this. It's not about what I said or didn't say. It's about their objective to be able to drive an establishment. And by the way, a never-Trumper globalist neocon agenda, and that includes Liz Cheney, the neocon, number one neocon in Congress.
Yeah. So why is the left so much better than the right in keeping it together? You mentioned the Kavanaugh hearings. That's a perfect example. I mean, they work in team effort, in lockstep, no matter what does who or who does what. Even with the controversy lately within their own party with the squad there, whatever the hell you want to call them.
The quad squad.
The quad squad. Yeah. Well, a lot of people are calling them the four horsemen, right? So they got a lot of nicknames. Let me say that. Why honestly, truly question, why is the left so much better at that? I just never can figure this out because really they have pushed a socialist agenda. I mean, did you ever think we'd be having the conversation at this point about socialism and communism in America like we're doing right now with the water cooler?
I never would have expected that to be the case. And when I first went to Congress, they told me that Bernie Sanders was a socialist. One of those late votes, maybe 1:30 in the morning, I went over there, sat down next to Bernie and talked to him. And that's when we first got to know each other a little bit. And I just flat asked him, are you a socialist? And he said, yes, I am. And he defended his position. He's done it ever since. He got a lot of traction. He nearly won. I think he might have won the Iowa caucus
if they didn't
over Hillary in the last cycle. Yes, that's right. Yeah. And you look at our campuses, the curriculum that's there, you know, who's teaching supply side Adam Smith economics and the socialist agenda that's there. So it creeps into their minds. They are taking over their curriculum and the tenure professors are driving this. It creeps into the minds of people like AOC and they go spout that off and they get elected in an enclave that just thinks, well, they are just hardcore leftists, and they are not exposed to conservative thought. As a matter of fact, a little bit older lady, still a young one, that looked like she could have been AOC's sister, spoke to me in a Chinese restaurant in Washington the other day. She was she was one that had actually been protesting Kavanaugh, and we got into a friendly conversation that lasted for 3 hours in the Chinese restaurant. She had never talked to a conservative in her life. Mm-hmm. And so it was friendly. She wanted her picture taken, and that was great. We need more of those kind of conversations. They don't take place, though, obviously.
Yeah, no, they don't take place at all. Listen, the New York Times, you just mentioned here, in that interview, they say, quote, they say in quotes that you said, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization. How did that language become offensive? I want to ask you straight out, are you a racist?
Well, no, and I probably can do more to prove I'm not a racist than anybody in Congress. And, you know, it's awfully hard to disprove a negative allegation. Some say it's impossible to disprove a negative. Right. So I'm halfway through this. I have got thousands of pictures that prove the opposite. While they were spending millions calling me a racist in October and early November of last year and continued, while they were doing that, we did 28 events for the Tanzanian Miracle Kids. Three kids who were the survivors out of 38 in a bus wreck in Tanzania, 10 to 12 years old. And the doctors that did this, we flew them back to Sioux City, Iowa, out of Arusha, Tanzania. and they had 25 serious fractures, two fractured spines. I could go on. They were on death's door. They're alive today. We brought them back to the U.S., and we did events for them so they could say thank you, and we could raise more money for them to support the cause. 28 events in the month before, actually 3.5 weeks before the election, and raising money for that cause while they're calling me a racist. And, you know, additionally, the Haitians, when they're in town, they come to my office. They want me to help them. I help them. I just dealt with an issue on Haiti yesterday. This goes on and on, but I've gone into the worst places in the world, Haiti included. That's probably the hardest place in the Western Hemisphere. Down into Southern Africa, I was the first one to lead the standing ovation for George W. Bush on antiretroviral drugs for Africa. And it's just people, I have no accusers, none, that have any personal experience. You've just got Kevin McCarthy, who wants to, and he wants to sort that conference so that he can run it himself with one iron fist. I completely disagree with that approach. Every one of us that has a vote card has a unique franchise with our 700 plus thousand constituents, and they're the ones that we're accountable to and nobody else. And even then, it has to be the principles that we have said we stand for that can be unshakable. And then we hang the needs of the district on that framework. And that's worked really good for me for all these years. I've said I owe my constituents my best effort and my best judgment, and I give them that. But it isn't to hand my vote card over to Kevin McCarthy or anybody else.
Well, most Republicans believe that Kevin McCarthy is part of the establishment. They refer to him as, in fact, a component of the deep state, quite frankly. Let me just put that out there. Are you part of the establishment?
I'm so far away from that. The establishment is attacking me every day.
Exactly.
And so that's the fact that one of my primary opponents was asked that point blank question. Mm-hmm. Are you the establishment candidate? And he deflected it, didn't answer it. But it's already becoming clear that the establishment has recruited at least one primary opponent for me. And I think it is one. Mm-hmm. And that I see who writes the checks. It's establishment people that, you know, they didn't like not being able to pick the president because I was in the way. And it's also the open borders people who want cheap labor. I mean, the modern day equivalent of slavery at labor. And they tell me we pay good wages. So that's not the issue. But those good wages they pay are pretty close to what Democrats just passed off the House as minimum wage.
Explain to me, I don't want to lose to ask you the follow-up on that New York Times piece, when the words that they've quoted you, because I'm seeing it on kinds of videos and all kinds of things, they're branding you as a racist. I mean, that's what they're trying to brand you with, and this is what the left does really well. But when you made the comment, in what context was that, Congressman, when you said white nationalists, white supremacists, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? What was the point of that?
Okay, first of all, you know, I said that's a misquote, so I don't concede that I even said those first two terms.
I see.
Although if I did, it would have been in response to his specific question about them. But it was a 56-minute interview, and there is no tape. Whatever notes are there are in the possession of the New York Times. They will not divulge them. He will not even speculate as to what question he might have asked me that brought this quote out. Mm. So it's hard to reconstruct a context that I suspect didn't happen. But there is another interview that gives some insight into this. This interview took place before the New York Times interview, but was published after the New York Times story. And it was with the Christian Science Monitor. Oh, let's see. I don't remember her name, but it's a young lady that her family originates from the Philippines. And in any case, that I have talked a couple of times about the weaponization of language. And so if I were going to give you the string of this, that I would be addressing, it would be this, that the word racist is a worn out, tired, dog-eared card, and they only had one card to play, and they played it over and over again. In fact, April Ryan ambushed me at the convention in Cleveland in 2016 and began driving that word racist at me, and I said...
Well, they've changed now. They're now using the word white supremacists. They're off the racist word now. Now it's white supremacists. You know that. They keep changing.
Well, and they cooked that up at the Mandarin Hotel in Washington, D.C., starting November 12, 2016, and their big lament gathering there. And they were going to plan what they were going to do to exploit the Hillary presidency, and they had to change their agenda. But here's what weaponized terms. It's not only that. They weaponized, of course, racists, Nazi fascist. When that page came at me, I was stunned that how can you put a label like that on a full spectrum constitutional Christian conservative, knowing that there are thousands of crosses in graveyards across Europe to put an end to Nazism, and they were American graves there. So that's Nazi fascist doesn't fit. They weaponized them anyway, and then they went on with white supremacists, white nationalists first, and white supremacists. And so if those words did come out of my mouth, and I say it, I doubt if they did, but no one knows but God, and surely the New York Times doesn't know. But in any case, it would have been, here's this list of all of these terms that they have weaponized, and there was a pause in my delivery. I learned this when I was trying to reconstruct this the Saturday after it blew up on the previous Thursday, and then I knew that if I said this, it comes down to this. Here are all these words that are they've weaponized, and then I've been a pause, and Western civilization. How did that language become offensive? And by the way, the word that is singular. It's not plural, so it doesn't include those two odious ideologies prior to it. And then I followed that with, why did I sit in classrooms listening to the merits of our culture? And if you'd finish it out, it would have been only to find out these years later that it's a pejorative term. I was defending Western civilization. If you do a LexisNexis search on me, going clear back to the year 2000, you'll find that I had never been quoted ever uttering the words white nationalist or white supremacy. It wasn't in my vernacular. It wasn't in our discussion. The left brought that up. But I had been quoted 276 times defending Western civilization. And so that pretty much puts the kibosh to Kevin McCarthy's theory. But here's another one, and that is that white nationalists weaponized. We checked that out without regard to my name. How often was it used in print back to the year 2000? Virtually not at all, meaning 1 to 200 times a year in all the publications scanned by LexisNexis, until you get to 2016 and it jumps to 10,000 times. 2017, 30,000 times.
There it is.
2018. Yeah. They weaponized the term, and now they're attacking.
Yeah, but if you can't talk about policy, Congressman, if they don't want to talk about policy, obviously they don't want to talk about the economy, and they certainly don't want to talk about immigration. They want to talk about babies being offended, but they don't want to talk about policy. So what you got to do is you have to distract. So this is a perfect, actually, they're pretty smart, the left is. This is what they use to distract. You see, distraction politics, right? I mean, it's perfect.
Well, it is, and I don't know that I've got the quote committed to memory the way I should have, but it has to do with a piece of wisdom about how the elitists, and they can be on the left or the right, have a way of taking a fact and assigning a belief system to it, and then attacking the person whom they've assigned that belief to. That's absolutely what they do. And it's been said more eloquently than I just did, but I think I got the message across.
Well, the left, again, is brilliant when it comes to projection politics. Projection politics. They're perfect at it. So everything they're doing wrong is what they project on the right. And it's a winning strategy for them, clearly. Having said all of that, when it comes to this whole conversation about racism and what's really dividing the country right now, there's a perception out there. To a lot of people, a lot of Americans, that the Democrats are more diverse and welcoming to all ethnicities, yet the Republican Party seems to struggle with that, Congressman. That's been a real struggle with the right. They haven't done as well, even with women, for that matter, embracing women. I know there are strides to change that, but that's been a real problem within the election cycle for Republicans, hasn't it?
Well, it is if you look at it demographically. And of course, I don't like the politics of demography or division. I'd rather look at this, that we're all God's children created in his image, and we have the same desires. Most of us have some core of our faith, and we love our families, and our families nurture us. And that those are the things that should pull us together. But if we have to identify ourselves first by skin color, which Democrats do, they are constantly on that message. Whenever they look at somebody, they already put them in a category. They can't see the humanity until they get them sorted into the categories that they're going to have special preferences for. And they have calculated that. It's their political strategy. I want to get away from it. I've said this to many minorities and in public meetings, too. It's not about race. It's never been about race. It's about culture. And some people use race as a marker for culture. but it's not about race. If name your race of people, and if they happen to be the ones that were successful and doing well, and their families were together and they were law abiding and all, everybody want to be that color. They'd want to emulate that. It's not about race. And it's going to take a long time for me to convince the rest of the world that, but on this one, I know I'm right, Malcolm.
Yeah, gotcha. One of the things I'm finding out that I want to talk to Congressman King about in just the next moment here, people, is about our diversity. What is America's strength, which is our diversity, is what we seem to be pulling ourselves apart with as a country here. We'll take that up next with the Congressman in just a moment.
Our global experts are brilliant writers and engaging hosts on a mission of a lifetime. You'll find the latest news and inspiration on the front page of AmericaOutloud.com.
The question I always get asked is, where do I get the energy from? Well, keeping up with Malcolm Out Loud is no easy task, friends, even for Malcolm. Well, you may know that I've personally been taking Healthy Cell for some time now. Well, the great news is Healthy Cell has a new type of natural supplement called the Nutrition Gel. So no more hard-to-swallow pills. The good-tasting gel can be mixed into smoothies, yogurt, or water. These gels provide maximum absorption of essential nutrients, and it's healthy for our gut, not abrasive like pills can be. You know, it's time for all of us to go pill-free. And you can try it with a free 2-day supply. Just cover $2.95 shipping, and the company, Healthy Cell, will cover the cost of the product. Go to healthycell.com/outloud or simply click the Healthy Cell logo at the top of AmericaOutloud.com. You know, Congressman King, I see that as a strength for America, America's diversity, yet there are so many trying to divide the nation within this diversity. You made a comment that you came out and you tweeted a message that you said diversity is not our strength. But you went on to explain again, and here's part of the question. I think what people can see in listening to you today here, many things are taken out of context. I want to put it back into context, and I want to talk to you right now because you sent a message out and tweeted and said, assimilation has become a dirty word to the multiculturalist left. Assimilation, not diversity, is our American strength. I want to just have you explain that a little more, please.
Well, sure. If we continue to focus on multiculturalism and diversity and just celebrate the diversity itself, and we've given up on assimilation 25 years ago or so, then America eventually separates itself against itself if we aren't able to assimilate. And I got a good signal on this, an indication on it. Shortly after I was elected to Congress the first time in 2002, it would be November, early December 2002, I invited in representatives from 14 different minority groups in Sioux City, and I listened to them for 90 minutes. And when it was done, I said, I don't have time to answer all the things you said. I've got notes on it all, but I'm going to ask one thing of you, and then I got to catch the next meeting. Slide up on the front of your seat and express to me with body language how you feel about one word, and I'm going to say one word. They slid up on the front of their seats, and I said the word assimilation. And they all pushed themselves back and physically rejected it and verbally complained. Mm-hmm. They rejected assimilation now. They were the leaders of of 14 different minority leaders of minority groups at that table. And that's reflective of what I have seen ever since then. Mm-hmm. Getting back to assimilation is going to be difficult, but if we don't do that, it's not a strength anymore and without assimilation. And you see where societies go when they're divided.
Congressman, thank you for explaining that and putting that out there, because we've been talking about that in recent times here on the network, in recent days here, quite frankly. And we've seen what's happened with Europe. We've seen the divide there. We've seen what diversity has done there. But diversity, just for the sake of diversity, is not healthy for anybody, is what really we're saying here. America is becoming divided more than a melting pot. It's becoming more of a division. And that's going to be reflected more, I think, over the next 20, 30 years as this country, we're at a real tipping point in this country, are we not?
Well, we don't know until we look back on history, I think, Malcolm, on that. But it's a precarious place, whether we've yet arrived at the tipping point or not. I don't yet know. But I want to comment, too, that It's human nature for people to migrate towards like kind. And
because we're tribal in nature, Congressman. That's exactly it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And when I went to my family reunion years ago, I was probably in my early 20s when I first saw this, and we hadn't been together in 10 or more years. And this tribe of my family on my mother's side, there are five siblings in that family, each having five kids. They each set up their nuclear family. The kids were pretty much grown, but they each set up their nuclear family at a picnic table, kind of separate from each other, got out their picnic baskets and their coolers, and associated with the people they associated with constantly. And I went to one of the tables, sat down. I was at a family reunion. I should be mixing things up, talking to people that I wouldn't get to see again for a long time. And I noticed that after a while, two of them would get up and go sit at the next table, then another one. Pretty soon, I've got the captive audience of one. I get up and go do that at another table as an experiment. And after three of those tables, the signal's clear. And it's still true. On the King side of the family, we got together mid-July. I did the same thing, saw the same thing. So just because you want to associate with like kind doesn't mean you're a racist necessarily. And but here's another, here's a good kind of an example. In the small school district where my three sons grew up, there was 503 kids in that school altogether, K-12. The principal was required to fill out a federal form on how many minorities were in the school. And he wrote out a report that said none. But he forgot about an African-American kid who had been adopted into a family there. And he forgot about a little Japanese kid that had been adopted into a family. And so he put down none. But the reason he forgot about them is because they were so assimilated in society from kindergarten up that just didn't occur to him or anybody that they should have a category. And by the way, one of those young men today owns his own trucking firm, the African-American young man does, and he's doing fine. He's one of us and part of the neighborhood completely, and he's embraced and accepted for who he is. And the other one, I pointed to the Coast Guard Academy, and he's serving, as far as I know anyway, still in the Coast Guard. So that's a good place to be, but we're a long ways from there, and I think we're further from that now than we were before Barack Obama was elected.
Congressman, how is Trump doing as a president?
Boy, that is a hard question. I say, here's what I'm hearing. I'm looking at cornfields right now, and the people out here are they're generally conservative people. They know where that all new wealth comes from the land. They have to take the good and the bad and even things out over a lifetime. Mm-hmm. There's a good crop, a bad crop. They're sticking with the president on the trade negotiations. Not with chest thumping vigor. There's no victory dance out here, but they understand that we have to go through this. And then the pushback comes from, there are people out there that don't like what he tweets. They don't like the issues that he takes. They think he should let people that aren't very high profile go and not worry about taking on every battle. I don't think that scares people off of supporting him. The election were held today. Trump wins Iowa. And, I told him one day, I said that, you know, that I market tested his immigration policy in this state for 14 years before he came. Yeah. And so he should hit it. And that immigration policy looks pretty much like mine today.
Wow. Wow. Is the president too divisive?
Well, I wouldn't make that statement because it wasn't he that started this fight. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had most of those perpetrators, and I'll call them that, before me under oath in the Judiciary Committee, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page. You can go higher, much higher up the ranks. I've questioned pretty much all of them. And I want to see this unfold out of the Justice Department, but they tried to take down him as a candidate. They tried to take him down as a president-elect, and they still tried to take him down after he was sworn in as president, and some of the leftover people that didn't get moved out of those departments quickly enough. Yeah. They weaponized the highest levels of government against Donald Trump. So that's never happened before, at least to that degree. And I'm not going to judge President Trump for fighting for his presidential life. Somebody's got to do it, and if he's not strong enough, the rest probably don't know enough to take over and do it for him.
To your point, he's had to play defense from day one. You're exactly right. And everybody knows it. I mean, he's been on the defensive right there. They put him there initially with the whole Russia, Russia, Russia is where it all started there. And it's kept going from there. But you can kind of see when you've got somebody that is a canoe rocker like a Donald Trump, he's going to upset a lot of people. He's going to irritate them. And because he's going against the status quo. He's going against the establishment, and establishment people don't like him. him. I mean, you know full well Paul Ryan did not like Donald Trump any more than Mitt Romney did, or that Kasich did. So there's a whole litany of those kinds of people, clearly. Listen, does Trump win in 2020, you think? Or can anybody give him a challenge from the left?
And when I look at that lineup of candidates, without looking at that lineup of candidates, I think Trump wins in 2020. It's going to be dependent upon where this economy goes, and you see a lot of news coming up about the economy being less stable.
Oh, you mean
right
that
now.
They're wishing that it's a recession? You mean that's the new racist word, recession?
That's right. Yeah, they're wishing that it's a recession so they can get Trump out of office. They will be also timing and choreographing moving up to impeachment. I'll make this prediction here, and I haven't done it publicly before. There will be impeachment hearings in the House of Representatives, and it will be timed in such a way to do the maximum damage to Donald Trump's reelect.
Yeah,
that's why it's taken them so long to get this unlimbered. So we'll see that. And then I look at the presidential candidates that have emerged on the other side, and it looks like if there's somebody there that's a moderate voice, they don't have much traction with the folks that they're at least being polled with right now. So it doesn't look like they can field a candidate that can be sold or marketed to the voters across America, except for those enclaves we talked about.
Yeah, I think you're right with your opinion on impeachment. It's all about timing. That's why we haven't seen it yet. But it is really about timing, because they want to forecast that right with the 2020 election. And they're also looking for a time bomb with all these investigations. And it doesn't have to be accurate or true, Congressman. It just needs to be something they come up with that they can throw out into the public square, that they can sort of cultivate those votes and try to get those middle America to turn against the president. That's how you win. That's how the left will try to win this election. That's all they got, Congressman. And you kind of can't blame them for being strategic and kind of smart, because they really don't care about the country. They care about the election. Do you agree?
Well, they care about the election. That's true. They have a voracious appetite for power, but they have defied logical two-party politics. And that takes a little explanation when I say that. But here's how this has worked for years and how it's supposed to work. And that is that, let's just say you lose an election. The political center exists somewhere. Think of a teeter-totter, and the fulcrum is the political center. And so you're over there with the voters you've got on one side of that seesaw, and the other party's on the other side. And the decision's made, the voters come in. Let's just say Republicans win majorities across the board. Well, what's their choice? They can either pile more voters on their end to try to counterbalance and get it to come their way, or they can move the political center so that fulcrum is an advantage to them. Mm-hmm. But that's naturally what happens is, well, if we lost and we're too far left, we move further to the right so we can, pick up some of those voters that will go on the other side. They are not doing that. They're moving further and further to the left, and they've taken the debate to the left, and you've got, the quad squad that are driving this debate, along with presidential candidates that are saying, well, we need free health care for every illegal immigrant, and we're not going to close the border. We're going to let anybody that comes to America needs to become an American, and we'll confer citizenship on them if that's without their will, without even their wish. But even further than that, they are working to abolish citizenship and just turn citizenship into residency and eliminate the nation state and border lines. This is a globalist agenda, and it's George Soros, and it goes back to George Soros's father, but it's many others. And if they had to live by the consequences of their policies, they would have to change their mind. But they are elitists, so they see themselves living in gated communities, managing over all of the proletariats out there that they've pushed into poverty because they've taken away the incentive for people to work and improve their own lives. That's a big part of this equation, but the odd thing is they didn't move that fulcrum by adopting some policies that are more conservative. They went further to the left, so now they have to be more radical, and they have to tell more lies and call more names.
Yeah, very well said. What's the, and our last word, a minute or so left, what's the future for yourself? Obviously, I detect you're not giving up here. You're gonna continue this fight. I can see that you have a lot of spirit in you still, so.
Well, I don't think any member of Congress has ever been targeted like I've been targeted. And so it's not necessarily a new tactic, but we've taken it so far, they've taken it so far that it's new territory. And this includes Republican leadership, Kevin McCarthy, Liz Cheney. It includes some of the Republican leadership here in the state of Iowa, too. If you take them out of the equation, I don't have a problem if Republicans aren't taking shots at me. but every position that I have been attacked for is a principled conservative position that's reflected by the platform itself. And so they are doing damage to our platform. But if I let these tactics win, oh, I didn't tell you this either, Malcolm, is that I got a heads up before Christmas that they were going to launch a firestorm attack on me. And they told me who was going to be the messenger, how it was going to come down. I preempted this at the White House to the extent I could. And then I met with that supposed messenger on January 8th. That messenger said, well, I would never do this to you, Steve, which is what any messenger would say if they were called out on it. That was January 8th. January 9th, I get the high-profile primary opponent announced by Twitter. It had no rollout procedure, just announced quickly. January 10th, the New York Times story came out, and the rest is history. So what here amounts to is this, that the easy thing for me to do would be, you know, go fishing the rest of my life. I actually have better cash flow if I'm not in Congress, but that wouldn't be the right thing to do. The right thing is we cannot reward these kind of tactics. We cannot let them win. If they win with these kind of tactics, they will deploy it against the next most effective member of Congress and the next most effective one until such time as the entire system is completely corrupted and you end up with one person calling all the votes in the Republican side in the House, one person calling all the votes on the Democrat side, and those two people cutting a deal that roll the American people and the taxpayer and the citizens. And if that's going to happen, I told him this, if that's going to happen, you're going to have to shoot me down in the middle of Main Street at high noon with everybody watching. There's no easy way to do this. And then they said, well, what would be the conditions by which you wouldn't be on the ballot in 2020? And I said, if I'm dead, that's the only condition. So I hope I've expressed myself clearly on that.
Well, that is pure conviction there and determination for sure. You're listening to the voice of Congressman Stephen King. The other very interesting takeaway here, beyond all of this talk of racism and supremacy and again, the heartbeat laws, is the impeachment point where he says, yeah, it's all about timing. It's all about timing. Remember that, because that's going to come back, I believe, in a very, very big way. It's time to get involved and get loud.